Hello, everyone, and welcome to the NATO Association of Canada podcast series. I'm Michael DeLeo, and today I have the great privilege of interviewing Kevin McCurgan. He is currently the British Consul General and Director General for UK Trade and Investment in Toronto. Originally from Scotland, Kevin joined the Foreign and Commonwealth Office in 1990. Since that time, he has worked as a diplomat during critical periods of British foreign policy, often dealing with issues of terrorism, migration, regional stability, and security. Immediately prior to coming to Toronto, he was the British Consul General in Miami. Mr. McCurgan, thank you once again for sitting down today. It's great to speak with you.
Thank you very much for having me here.
So if you could just start off by telling our listeners a little bit about your personal and educational background.
How did that all influence you to embark upon a career in the Foreign Service?
I joined the Foreign Service in 1990 at the age of 18. I think what really influenced me was the fact I come from what's probably called a service family. My father was in the Royal Navy and had visited Canada during his time in that. And my grandfather had been in the Royal Navy during World War II. Both of them had seen the world. I was really keen to see the world as well. I was less keen, I suppose, to actually join the military and follow in their footsteps. And on the school notice board back then was an advertisement to join the British Diplomatic Service. And I applied. And that's where it went from there.
You've served in so many other parts of the world, and this is your first time in Canada, your first posting here, correct?
That's correct. So I've been a diplomat now for 26 years. I've covered every continent along the way. I've had the privilege to live in Toronto for 2 years so far, and I'm the Consul General here, but also the head of the British government's trade and investment operations in Canada.
And if you could compare Canada to some of the other parts you've served in, what would be some of the biggest differences?
So the biggest difference, I think, if I was to compare it with, say, my time in the Balkans after the Dayton Peace Agreement, or my service in Afghanistan, both times when I worked closely with NATO, quite clearly the stability here, a stable, liberal democracy with a strong economy. And both of those places and regions had experienced, in some cases decades, in others 5 years of conflict, terror, and destabilization. Those are some of the extremes. If I was to pick a similarity, one place I served was Sweden for 2 years, and a Northern European nation that I think shares much in common with Canada, not just with the cold.
Right, okay. Diplomacy, it's something that just has such a huge history in the world. And there's so many positions. There's ambassador, consul generals. What are some of the tasks that you fulfill as consul general in Toronto?
So I've really got three roles as a consul general here. The first role is to build relationships with everybody in Toronto and Ontario who is of interest and importance to the British government. Explain to them what's happening in the UK, particularly after Brexit, and also explain to my colleagues in the UK what people in Toronto and Ontario think of what's happening there. The second is I'm responsible for promoting trade and investment, so that's helping British companies enter the market, do business here, and making the case for Canadian investors and businesses to establish themselves in the UK or to trade with the UK. Finally, and this is one of my most important roles, I am responsible for delivering the services for British nationals who may find themselves in a spot of bother, whether that is they've lost their passport and they need an emergency travel document, or perhaps they might need some advice if they find themselves on the wrong side of the law, and we can guide them to the right people who can provide that.
So prior to serving as Consul General here in Toronto, what have been some of your most memorable positions?
So, as I mentioned earlier, I've been on every continent. Immediately prior to here, I was a consul general in Miami, which was a similar role, but also involved a lot of collaboration with US law enforcement, as I had some responsibility for the Caribbean. Immediately prior to that, I was the deputy head of the provincial reconstruction team. In Helmand province in Afghanistan, responsible for dispersing British government assistance for stabilization projects or longer-term development projects. And if I think back even further, I was in Sweden in the early 2000s, where I was the head of the political and economic section, responsible for producing political and economic advice and analysis on what was going on in Sweden and why that mattered to the UK.
And just reading your bio, between 2005 and 2008, you were deputy head of the Iraq Policy Unit in the Foreign Office.
Correct.
What was it like to serve in such a position, especially when you're dealing with a part of the world, with a country that has faced a lot of difficulty, a lot of destruction? What was it like?
So I was based in London. It was an intense time for all concerned, especially for our staff on the ground. And I was responsible for oversight of the security sector reform programs that the UK provided, whether that was training and reforming the Iraqi police or providing assistance to the armed forces. It was a time when we were also drawing down our armed forces in Iraq. We were also increasing our armed forces in Afghanistan, so we were shifting between theatres. And it was also a time when, I think it's fair to say, public consent for our presence on the ground in Iraq, that's UK public consent, was diminishing. However, I learned a huge amount from it. I learned about the importance of public consent for military operations overseas. I learned a lot about how our government staffs itself in order to be able to deliver those military operations and humanitarian assistance. And finally, I learned a lot about the importance of effective coalitions. I did a lot of time working with the Americans, but also with a number of our other partners in southern Iraq, like Denmark.
And generally speaking, the UK, it exercises an incredibly important leadership position in the world. So what are the critical foreign policy issues that the UK is focusing on right now?
So you're right to recognize, I think the UK does play a leadership role. We're a key member of NATO. We are a permanent member of the Security Council. We are one of the only nations that meets both the 2% spending target for NATO as well as the 0.7% gross national income target set by the United Nations for development assistance. Our current foreign policy priorities cover the gamut of what's on the world today, from tackling Daesh and the spread of Daesh in the Middle East, supporting efforts on the Middle East post-peace process, making sure that our eastern sort of flank and the Baltic states feel secure and standing up to Russia, and doing whatever we can to deliver a peaceful outcome in Syria, and at the moment in particular, focusing on the delivery of humanitarian assistance, where we are the second largest humanitarian assistance contributor behind the United States.
So what are some of the things that the UK and Canada are doing right now with NATO?
So we're doing lots. I mean, and we do that from the basis of shared heritage around shared systems, the rule of law, and long-standing interoperability between our armed forces stretching back to World War I. The most important thing I think we're working on now is the deployment of Canadian and British alongside German and American battalions to the Baltic states in 2017 to bolster security and defense in those states against Russia. But we're also working and have worked sort of globally on a number of issues. So we are part of the coalition tackling the spread of Daesh in both Syria and Iraq, where Canada is providing much needed advice on the ground and training. We've also worked in Africa in the past to tackle Ebola in West Africa. And we do a lot of joint training. So for example, earlier this year, we had the Royal Navy involved in the largest exercises alongside the or Canadian Navy, just off the eastern coast here, alongside the United States, reskilling ourselves in our anti-submarine warfare capability. So I think there's not a day that goes by where there isn't some form of UK-Canada contact between our armed forces.
Despite the fact that the UK is still very much involved with its allies, including Canada, there was, of course, the Brexit referendum that took place. What would you say to those who have this idea that it represented the UK's retreat from globalization, that it wants to look more within itself. What would you say to those people?
So I'd make the following points. First, Brexit was about the UK leaving the European Union. It wasn't about us leaving Europe. As already mentioned about our military commitments next year to the Baltic states, we continue to supply ships on migrant operations in the Mediterranean, and we continue to have a global presence, whether it's the Five Powers Defence Agreement in South Asia, to working on development of the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter, to next year we'll complete the first of our two aircraft carriers, Her Majesty's ship Queen Elizabeth II. The second thing I would say is, as I mentioned earlier on, we're one of only three nations, actually, Poland, the United States and the UK, that meets the NATO targets for both defence spending and defence spending on capabilities, and that will continue. And finally, we have always seen NATO as the cornerstone of European defence. We have long committed to the different organisations within NATO, whether it's the Allied Rapid Reaction Force or the Very High Readiness Joint Task Force, and that will not change. So although I understand when people say, you are going to be looking inwards, everything I've seen since from my government and its commitments to both defence as well as to international trade tells me that actually we're going to be very much a global Britain going forward.
And even though Brexit was something that, was a referendum that was held over the course of, a day, the issues upon which it is based stem back decades. So what, in your opinion, were some of the reasons why a majority of people in the UK decided to leave? To leave the European Union. So why did Brexit happen? Because we hear so many things, there's so many arguments that are put out by the media, but what, in your opinion, were the main reasons?
So if you take a step back, we don't have exactly the same experiences that our continental allies and partners have had when it comes to the European Union. If you stem back to how we emerged after the end of the Second World War, and that provides a backdrop to this. I think, secondly, the perception of unrestricted migration from within the European Union played a role. And thirdly, I suspect for some people, a perception of just ongoing shifts within the European Union over the last 4 to 5 years, whether it's been the debate about Brexit on the one side or migration on the other. The key thing is, though, I think that having had the referendum won by a majority, the government has taken the decision to respect that and to now take forward implementation of that decision, beginning with in March next year, setting out the letter, the Article 50 process to renegotiate our relationship with the EU. If it had not done so, I think that would have been even more challenging.
Right. And I think that's fair to say, because even though Brexit, passed, as you mentioned when you answered previous questions, the UK is still very much interested in acting with its allies and being a global player. But next year, there are going to be elections in Germany and France, and especially in France, many people speculate that the far right has a chance to win. And especially when you think about its position on Russia, it represents a departure from the previous French government. Are you worried about this? Do you think that it can lead to a significant weakening of European cohesion?
So the one thing I've learned is never to get too far ahead and make predictions of the future, because you have those two sets of elections. Europe through the last 5 years, or the EU, has had some bumpy times, but it is still here today, and we want the European Union to continue to be a success. France is an incredibly valuable partner in a range of defence issues, and that's long been recognised through a bilateral treaty of Saint-Malo between the UK and France, and I don't see that particularly changing. Final point I'd say is I think we in what might be called the West are seeing an interesting period with the rise of populism, and that's not just on the right, it's also on the left as well. You can see an interesting elections. How politicians respond to that will be interesting to watch in the next 12 months.
The recent president-elect in the United States, many people have looked at his campaign rhetoric and suspect that he may scale back American commitment to the transatlantic alliance. What's your opinion on that?
So I think the US sees the transatlantic alliance and NATO in the same way the UK does, and will continue to do so, as the cornerstone of North Atlantic security. The US, like the UK, meets the targets that NATO has set for itself for all member states of NATO to meet by 2024. The US maintains bases in Europe. It provides the bulk of airlift capacity. Now, I equally think that actually there is an argument to be said that all member states of NATO do need, though, to get on the glide path up to meeting that 2% target. That's something that the US has been saying for a long time, as has the UK. And this may provide some more focus on that.
In your opinion, NATO, does it still play a valuable role in the world?
A valuable and an essential role. I think if you were talking to my Latvian, Estonian, Lithuanian or Polish colleagues, they would definitely echo that. Indeed, anyone on our eastern flank. Likewise, in the Mediterranean today, whether particularly tackling and supporting operations tackle migration flows. And fundamentally, you know, if you want to put it in these terms, NATO has been the guarantor of Europe's security and European Union's security for over 60 years now, and has that guarantee has enabled the rapid growth from predating NATO back to the Marshall Plan, for which European prosperity has been able to build on. And I think, you know, most European politicians recognize that and value that.
Canada, of course, UK ally, NATO country. Can you speak on the relationship between Canada and the UK?
We have a very deep relationship and often very integrated, whether that is between trade and investment, where for Canada, the UK is the second destination for most of their foreign investment after the United States, and we in turn are Canada's third largest trading partner. Whether it's on defence, and I've mentioned about the commitments to NATO, but the training, for example, that the British Army does here at British Army Training Unit Suffield in Alberta, to joint exercises between our navies, to our intelligence relationship. We're both part of the Five Eyes community alongside Australia, New Zealand and the United States. To links between higher education authorities and students learning in both directions. Yesterday we celebrated St. Andrew's Day, and to give you two statistics from that. Firstly, there are 1,000 Canadian students today studying in Scottish universities that go over every year. And secondly, there's a statistic from the previous census here where one out of every six Canadians claims some form of Scottish heritage. So for me, you know, we've not only got this deep relationship, it's a familiar relationship as well.
So for those who are interested in a career in diplomacy, what would be some advice you would offer to them?
It's a good question. So I would offer the following. The first is you have to be curious about not just the world, as in countries and how they get on, but you have to be curious about what you see immediately around you. You can read the books, you can take the statistics, but there is nothing better, in my view, as a diplomat than simply being able to get outside the front door, go for a walk, travel to a place, and see what's happening on the ground. So for me, you've got to be curious about the world. I think the second thing is you have to have and be prepared to be resilient. There's resilience in the face of when you see things that are rightly unjust and you're trying to do your best to resolve them or alongside allies, and it's heavy going and you're not getting the progress you'd like, for example, on the situation in Syria today, as well as just being resilient on moving around. In my career now, in 26 years, I've moved something like over 22 different times between different countries in and out, and it takes its toll on you. And the final thing is, I think as a diplomat, you have to be pragmatic. You have to deal with the world as it is at times, not as you wish it was, but you get the best out of it if you approach it with a sense of being positive and be a sense that you can actually, even if it's only by millimeters at times, make a difference and make a change. It's an incredibly rewarding role. It's incredibly rewarding career. And it's also, and I think with your Canadian, American, Japanese, German, South Africa, otherwise, it's a great honor to be able to represent your country overseas.
Would you like to leave our listeners with any final words?
I suppose my final words would be, in this role here, I've been privileged to live in Canada for 2 years. I have traveled the length and breadth from Newfoundland to Vancouver. Canada is an amazing country. It has a particular brand on the world that is respected, that is understood. With 2017 coming up and the 150th year of Canada's Confederation, I would just like to wish it now an early happy birthday.
Sure, as Canadians, we're all happy to hear that. Mr. McCurgan, thank you very much for sitting down today. It's always great to speak with people who not only have so much experience, but are always willing to share it. So we're thankful for that.
Thank you very much indeed.
On behalf of the NATO Association of Canada, thank you for listening.